Welcome to the Flow Podcast, fearlessly leading our way. This podcast is a space dedicated to spotlighting the unfiltered voices of Black women in their unique leadership journeys. I am your host, Angela B. Harris. I'm an award-winning coach, speaker, author, and champion for Black women. Make sure you like and subscribe to this podcast to stay connected to our conversation. Let's get ready to flow. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Flow Podcast, where we dive deep into the stories and journeys of incredible Black women. I am your host, Angela V. Harris. Today's guest is April Lancet. April is the CEO of April Lancet & Associates, a private practice that provides mental health services and support. Her areas of specialization include couples therapy, individual therapy, and Black mental health and wellness. April is a two-time graduate of LaSalle University, where she earned an Associate of Arts in Liberal Arts and her bachelor's degree in clinical psychology. She also holds a master's degree in marriage and family therapy from Drexel University. And in case you don't know, she bleeds blue and gold. April is the assistant professor and program director of the Marriage and Family Therapy Program at LaSalle University and the first African-American female to hold the role in the history of the university. She's been a guest lecturer for such organizations as NBC Universal, Comcast, and the Lynx Incorporated. She's also been featured on Temple News, Fox 29 News, and NBC 10. Welcome to the show, April.
Thank you for having me, Angela. Also,
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. This is an important conversation, especially within our community, especially with this going on within the workplace this year with Black women. So I'm so happy to have you on to share your insights with our guests.
Sure.
I read in your bio that you knew from an early age you were meant to be a therapist. And I'm curious, how did you even know what a therapist was at such a young age?
Well, I would say I just always was an observant child, always a listener, and people just always felt comfortable with sharing their stories with me. And as a young child, just listening, I always used to listen to people's story and think, I wonder how I can help facilitate this conversation. How can I make this situation a little bit better? I always would say, I wonder if so-and-so talked to so-and-so, maybe they would resolve this instead of trying to navigate this on their own. And as I grew up, I started to find more and more people would want to talk to me and share their story. And then I'm problem solving and strategizing on trying to help them. And so when I say as a little kid that I always felt this gift, I think some people are given a gift at an early age and they know that it's more than just going to school and getting your degree. I think it's a feeling, it's a calling. Mm-hmm. And for me, this has always been somewhat of a calling. And I often can't envision myself doing something else other than what I'm doing right now. Maybe a singer, but other than that, most of the time, I am always in my head trying to figure out how can I either help or support someone in need or a situation they're in.
Yeah, I love that you said the word calling. And I read a book a few years ago called Playing Big by Tara Moore. And she talks about calling. It's that feeling, that desire, that burning desire, that thing, that one thing that keeps you up at night. So from what you said, you are definitely operating in your calling.
Oh, yes. It definitely keeps me up at night. And I would say that it is something that, like, when most people are sitting and watching TV, I'm looking at the therapeutic dynamic of what's happening. I don't watch movies the same like other people, and I definitely don't have simple conversations either.
I love it. I love it. It's got to be so energizing for you. I know, like for me, now that I'm in the space of coaching, I'm so energized by the work that I do. And like you said, I'm up at night researching things, and I definitely realize that I'm looking at movies and TV shows from a different lens now that I'm in this space.
Sure, absolutely. I think once you kind of step into the world of either coaching or therapy, it's kind of like you don't look at the world the same. It's very internal, it's very mental, it's very emotional. Sometimes my daughter, who's 13, she always says to me, "Oh, mom, you're so emotional. Why are you crying?" I said, "'Cause I really understand like how people feel, and I feel that." And so that has been very much a part of my identity, is that I feel wholeheartedly for people and their situations and their circumstances, even if they have nothing to do with me. I'm always willing to listen and strategize if I can.
I know you're in a field where African Americans make up only 3% of mental health professionals. Walk us through your career journey.
Do we got time? No.
Ha.
My career journey is actually, I became a therapist actually with my bachelor's degree when I finished my time at LaSalle University. And one of my very first career positions was that I was a bachelor's level therapist, and I worked in a partial hospital with severe patients who had psychological disorders who were being recently discharged or released from inpatient hospitalization. And so that was my very first career as a therapist. And I was very young. I guess I'm 20, 21, 22 years old, and I'm a therapist. And when I took that position, I definitely, what's the saying? Well, my grandma would say, like, wet behind the ears. I definitely felt like I didn't know exactly what I was doing. I was one of the youngest members on the team. And I would definitely say on my journey, I've experienced a lot of different pivotal moments of like being the youngest, being the only woman, being a Black woman. And so I would say at that point, I was the youngest one on my team, and I had a lot of learning to do. And so I started doing individual and group therapy, and I continued to grow and work in the profession throughout the city of Philadelphia. So I have held many different roles as far as being a therapist and providing clinical services to families and children and couples. I would say my career started in the suburbs of Philadelphia, and then it pivoted into being more in urban areas in the city, mostly working with families that were from low income or diverse backgrounds, and going into their homes and getting to know them and getting to know their life, and realizing that everyone has a story. And sometimes we don't know as a therapist which part of the story we're going to come in on. And when we come in on those stories, it's up to me to figure out how I'm going to support them with where they are. So my journey has been, starting as a therapist, holding other roles in the field, and then eventually deciding I wanted to go out on my own and open up my own practice, which really was, a scary thing to do because I didn't know many people who were actually doing this and doing this work. I also did not really have a complete plan when I did this. I just knew that I wanted to do it. And I just took a leap of faith, developed my business plan, developed my goals, pitched the idea to friends, families, mentors. And I sat on the idea for a few years before I actually did anything. And I always laugh because humor is how I kind of laugh through me making decisions. And when I finally decided that I was going to open up the practice, I was at a pivotal moment in one of my careers, and I wasn't really too happy with how things were going. I didn't like how mental health was being provided to the clients at the time. And I just thought that our families, meaning Black and Brown families, could benefit from services in a unique way, especially couples therapy. Most of the time, mental health services and people's insurance does not pay for couples therapy, nor were people of color really having access to couples therapy. And so I decided I wanted to create a space where people felt safe and secure and wanted to work on their relationship and their marriage. Because I believe that, the two people that make up the relationship are the most important people. And I think if those people are solid, then we have solid children and then we have a better generation for the next generation. And so that was back in 2014. And here we are, the CEO of the practice. And over the years, it's grown so much that originally it was just myself and it was only going to be me. But then the demand for the services. And I think, like, when you think about Black people, we are really people that go by word of mouth. So if somebody tells you something good, then the other person tells you something good, then they go for it. And so with this practice, it has really grown tremendously by word of mouth. And that's how I added to my team and grew the practice to be what it is today. And my skills and experience has landed me in so many different rooms and so many conversations that I never envisioned that I would even be a part of. And I'm often feeling grateful and blessed about these opportunities. And sometimes it feels like my wildest dreams because all I ever wanted to do was to help couples and families and provide therapy. But it became so much more than that. Especially like finding myself on lists where I'm listed as a preferred Black provider, or I'm one of the top people that's listed when people are looking to work on their relationship. I think those are amazing contributions to have. And just being asked to speak about mental health, or asking to run a workshop, or asking to support for Women's Mental Health Month, or different initiatives related to mental health services. And then my recent endeavor is I became, as you mentioned, the first African American director of the Marriage and Family Therapy program at LaSalle University. And what I'm doing there is helping to support the next generation of therapists. And I think representation matters. And so having students that may look just like me see me in this type of role has been nothing but supportive and engaging to them. Even if, I support people of all walks of life, of walks of faith, I think it's a unique experience when you see someone that looks just like you, when really 3% of the population of therapists is not a whole lot.
Well, first of all, let me just congratulate you on the 10th anniversary of your practice. That's quite an accomplishment. And you are truly a visionary leader, operating in your gifting. What do you think has contributed to your success as a woman-owned business?
I would say along the way, knowing that just because you fail doesn't mean that that's it. I think that not giving up on a passion, a vision, a dream, even if in the beginning it doesn't like make sense to you. And there were definitely many days that I felt like, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't understand. But just building a relationship with different teams of people have been super supportive to me, being able to talk to people and run ideas past them. And then just ultimately making my own decisions on what I wanted to do next. And there were some times where I would go to, different mentors that didn't always agree with what I was thinking about doing. But in the end, it was still like my decision. Even when I went to different companies for the possibility to invest in my company, they didn't necessarily think it was a vision or that it was something that was worth putting money into. But I still believed in the vision and I didn't want to give up on that. And so I would say just learning how to stay the course. Even when you don't always have the supports to back you, I think developing relationships with people from other backgrounds is also important because even if they don't specialize in what you specialize, it doesn't mean that they don't have something to offer to you that can help you grow in a unique way.
Yeah, you talked about access to capital, and I know Black female businesses, struggle getting access to capital. What was your story with that? Were you able to get funding for your business?
There have been times, yes, that I have been able to get funding. In the beginning, not so much, right? Because when I first started, I didn't have a business plan. I didn't know what I was doing other than like seeing people for therapy and charging them nothing, which clearly we know that that isn't sustainable, but that was how I started. That was how I started. But I actually have participated in pitch competitions. I was a member of Black Girl Ventures, which I did a pitch competition with them, and I was up in the running with some of the leading companies that are leading today. One of those companies is recognized quite often, which is Win Win Coffee. We were in the same pitch competition. I think the other one was Shea Butter or Shea Butter, which was recognized by Beyonce, and they got like a huge grant. But I actually did not win. But what did come from that was that it was a lot of exposure. It was an opportunity for people to see therapists out there in the field. Because one of the things that I learned was not often were therapy practices or businesses pitching in competition. And at times it felt like, dude, does my business even fit in these competitions? But I was
Right.
still willing to give it a shot, and I didn't get turned away. So Black Girl Venture, Comcast, they actually did a spotlight on our business. We actually had a commercial that ran on the radio that also ran during hot times on Comcast cable stations. And I also won a competition last year, which was through Founders First, and it was for my practice, and it was funding that helped support it, the growth and expansion of the practice. And then my most recent endeavor that I met a lot of key people by being invited to Beyonce Knowles Carter Be Good Foundation luncheon. And I met so many different collaborators at that event. And one of the most recent was that I was awarded my minority owned business certification, women owned business through the her headquarters. And that was my most recent recognition that I received just 2 weeks ago.
I love all these humble brags you were throwing in, April. I mean, you were doing it, April. Congratulations and kudos to you.
You.
Now you said your practice started as you as the main therapist. How many therapists do you currently employ in your practice now?
So right now we are a team of five, which includes myself and four other therapists. We do have an administrator who works with our practice from project to project, but we are actually launching this year to hire our first full-time therapist, which is something that we're looking to do within the next few months. Especially since it's our 10th year anniversary, it's time for us to expand further. So at this time, we have five people that are both male and female, and they are all of color. I don't think I li initially thought that it was going to go that way, but that's just how it turned out. And it's been great because a lot of times when we get calls or emails, it's usually that people are asking to meet with a therapist that is shared lived experiences that represents their background, which happens to be Black or brown. And what I've seen as far as like the trend with therapy is that more people of color are coming to therapy. I think there was like a stigma in the community that said that men, especially Black men, don't go to therapy. There was at one time, Black men were actually one of our most served clients that was coming to our practice, and they actually were the one reaching out for couples therapy when
Wow.
I saw the trend happening. So it's been really magical. I say magical because historically, Black and brown people didn't go to therapy. So now
Yeah.
see that people of color are really doing this and they're staying committed to it. And they're doing the work themselves to reach out and get connected. I think that's an amazing trend that I hope will continue to trend and won't just be a trend.
Now, I know your practice is based in the Philadelphia area. Are you accepting new patients?
So currently, there is a wait list for myself, but the therapists that are at the practice are all open and accepting new clients.
And how are you talked about the stigma that the Black community has regarding therapy. How are you using your practice to normalize conversations around mental health in the Black community?
So one of the things that I typically do when clients come in, I always ask them like what their experience has been with mental health. Sometimes you'll get a story. Sometimes they'll get told, well, we don't do this. We don't believe in that. We don't talk about our problems. And so I try to normalize the conversation around, well, what does it mean to talk about your problems? Or I might say something along the lines of, well, could you tell me like what bad experiences that you had in therapy that's shaping your ideas today? They might say, well, the therapist abandoned me, or the therapist didn't really address my issues, or I was with a therapist who didn't really understand Black people's issues. That could be some of the things that we talk about. And so by normalizing that conversation, by making it seem as if we're having an everyday conversation, I think that that helps support people with feeling comfortable and feeling like they can do this work and that they can trust the person that is in the chair across from them or on the screen across from them. I think the more normalized the conversation is, I think the more willing people are willing to come to therapy. As far as we had a big referral pool from like primary care physicians in the neighborhood where my practice is located. And so for the longest time, they would refer clients to us all the time. And they would be, for the first time, they never did therapy before and they were curious. And so sometimes people would come in with their questions like, well, what does this look like? How does this go? What do you do? And so really just being available to answer the questions that people have, I think has helped. And I think normalizing it by letting them know, like, just like you go to your doctor for checkup, you should do the same for mental health. Not every place are you going to be able to go and talk all about you, but this is the space that you get to do that. And if it's really focused on you, no one's going to interrupt you. No one's going to tell you that you can't say this or you can't say that. This is really your space and your time. And that's what normalizing the conversation looks like.
You touched on this briefly, Bill. I just want to dig a little bit deeper. Can you discuss the importance of having culturally competent therapy and how that differs from traditional therapy approaches?
Yeah, so when we think about culturally competent therapy, we think about people having different circumstances and different lived experiences. And when a therapist really is able to tap into that and recognize that, they can fully support their client exactly where they are and how they show up in the space. When you don't have any sort of history or understanding of what it means to be Black in America, you are not the best therapist suited to support a Black and Brown client, as they could experience all sorts of racism, trauma, poverty, toxic stress, domestic violence, or just grief and loss. I think, one of the things I saw quite a bit when we were in the heart of the pandemic is that Black and Brown communities were experiencing extreme amounts of loss, more than the average white person. And so I think that just being able to hold space for that was significantly important. And I think like a person who isn't culturally competent could miss that opportunity to tap into how a person could be feeling when it comes to depression or anxiety or grief or loss right now. I think we're dealing with a lot of social isolation from one another. And I think people are trying to get back to building a sense of community and relationship connectedness. And some people are really, really struggling with this right now. And it has caused an increased level of stress, an increased level of anxiety. And being able to know what those experiences are like for Black and Brown people is significantly important if you're going to do therapy with them.
I agree.
Yeah. And I forgot about workplace trauma, right?
Oh, that's
Workplace
a
trauma.
whole nother conversation.
Sure. The year of the, what do they call it? The Great Resignation is what we saw. But we also saw an increase of Black entrepreneurs during this time. I think this is the time that we've had more than we've ever had in the history of our country. So it's interesting that during that time where people were leaving their jobs, all these creatives were coming up with new opportunities. And that is stressful, right? Because you're doing something brand new and you need to make a living for yourself and your family. So that's a whole nother level of therapeutic work, but people were coming to therapy for that too.
Okay. I want to talk about the concept of being a first. I know you're a first generation college graduate, and in your current role at LaSalle, you're the first African American woman to hold that role. How has being a first influenced your leadership style?
I would say one, I feel like it holds a lot of pressure, right? Because you want to make sure that the doors stay open for anybody that comes after me. And I think that it's more than just doing the job. So the job could be running the program and helping, master students become therapists. But I think that it's a pivotal moment because you get to be the person that's a part of somebody's memory and somebody's journey. And I think it's important for you to think about what impact do you want to make in that person's life and how do you want them to remember you. And so as a leader, I try to think about, the connections that I make with students, the connections I make with people, and what's going to be the lasting impact that they have with me. And, memories last for a lifetime. And we know that trauma can last for a lifetime. And so I definitely don't want to be a part of anybody's trauma. So if I can be preventative of that, I try to lead that way. I try to lead being authentically myself and authentically me and having some integrity in how I show up to the work and professionalism. But I'm also a down-to-earth Philly girl and I'm very relatable and I enjoy talking about professional things, but I also don't mind sharing personal aspects of my life and learning personal aspects of my students' life or anybody that I'm mentoring because we're human first and you're a person first. And so those are the things that I think about when it comes to being a leader and building relationships, that they need to be authentic, they need to be collaborative, and I think they need to have some form of honesty, even if the honesty can be slightly on the critical side, but critical in a way of helping people to grow, not to disvalue or devalue them or and make them feel that they're not worthy to be heard or be listened to. Or to just explore things that they're thinking about.
What I hear is that your legacy is very important to you. And you said memories last a lifetime and trauma lasts for a lifetime too.
Right? Doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
I know early in your career, you said you were like the youngest on your teams or the first and or both. How did you find your voice as a leader?
I would say it was hard at first because naturally I'm an introvert. And over the years I would say sometimes I'm a silent partner. I'm not always in the forefront, but I'm certainly behind the scenes making suggestions and comments, but maybe not in the forefront, always leading. And except now I'm a leader, so I have to have a voice now. And I have to speak. So sometimes you find yourself in positions where you have to step out of your comfort zone in order to make your presence known. And as far as finding my voice, I think there were many times that I can remember being very silent and not stepping up and not speaking up and then not feeling good about not doing that. And so I think when you learn from those experiences, I think the takeaway for me is, do I want to continue to be in a position of being silent, or do I want to be in a position where my voice can help? And maybe it's something that matters to other people and it could impact other people. So sometimes I call something the way I see it. The way I see it, I call it. Sometimes it's not easy and sometimes it's uncomfortable. And sometimes I don't always know, like, speaking up what the outcome is going to be. But if it's something that I feel very convicted about, then I'm certainly going to speak up about it and have a voice. But that didn't always happen throughout my career. There's definitely times that I've been silent. There's definitely times that I've just been an observer. There's definitely been times that I didn't know exactly how to navigate the situation. I'm a big advocate of journaling, and so a lot of times I would journal my feelings, or I would play out a situation or a scenario and think about, well, what would I have done differently if I had spoke up about it, or what could I have done differently? And so a lot of times I encourage people to write. I encourage people to get in tune with their story, to get in tune with who they are and how they show up to a space, because I think you can definitely be in positions where you can be very small and very silent, and people can walk all over that, especially if you aren't the person to speak up.
And like you said, don't be afraid to step out of your comfort zone to make your presence known.
Yes, that has something that has grown with me over time, and I think the more I find myself in places that I'm not just making a decision for me, but I'm making a decision that impacts other people, I think even more the voice matters. Because they always say, you need the seat at the table, you need a seat at the table, and you need to pull up to the seat, and you need to be able to give an opinion and be able to kind of back up your opinion on why you chose that and why you said that.
Pull up to the seat and give an opinion. Well, I want to shift gears and talk about the current state of Black women in the workplace. It's been an emotional few months, starting with Taraji Henson's emotional interview talking about pay inequity. Then we had the resignation of Dr. Claudine Gay and the untimely death of Dr. Antoinette Bonnie Candia Bailey. Black women are hurting. I know I'm hurting. What are some strategies for balancing mental health while still trying to lead effectively?
When I think about Black women, I think we have unique spaces, right? And one of those unique spaces is sisterhood. I think that that is extremely important for you to have that. I think having places where you can process your feelings, process your thoughts, even if, something happened in the work environment, I think you need to be able to fully authentically process how you've experienced it and how you felt about it, because you may not always be able to do that in the places that you work. And so I think having a community and a sisterhood is extremely important. I think that, as women, we tend to lead quite often and wear many, many hats. And I think it's okay to realize I can't always wear all the hats. And I think that it's okay to acknowledge that this hat may not be the hat that I can continue to carry. And because it's getting too heavy and the burden is too much to bear, I think being able to be in tune with yourself and know when to bow out is okay. I think sometimes when we bow out of something, I think people think that it means that you failed or that you didn't succeed. But the way I look at it is, if you find yourself in a position where you have to leave a position or you have to leave a situation, you already did the job. You just had to leave it. And it doesn't mean that it wasn't already done. And it doesn't mean that you don't have the title, because you certainly do. It just means that this part of your life no longer aligns with that position. And it's okay to step back and reshift the gears and find something else that does suit you, that does fit you, that does feel well. And I know sometimes Black women often can feel unseen and unheard and undervalued, and don't always feel like what their contributions that they give is valid. And maybe that's not the space for you to feel that. And there are times that you won't always be appreciated and you won't always be acknowledged. But I think the most important person is for you to be acknowledged and appreciated within yourself, and then having a strong community that can support and uplift you when you know that this may not be something that is good for my mental health or good for my well-being, or this may not even be the last career trajectory for myself.
Yeah, I
Something.
love that reframing because I feel like in our community, so many times we're told, suck it up, stick it out. We see that bowing out is a bad thing, but it's really not. Like you said, we've already done the job and you have to prioritize your mental health and well-being.
Yeah, I think so you mentioned when you were sharing about my background about Black women's mental health, one of the things was that was my clientele, right? A lot of Black women were coming to me for therapy and they were in tears. They were in pain. They were hurting. They were overwhelmed. They were stressed. They were burdened. They weren't happy. They talked about many, many different things. And of course, I can't share all the disclosures because of their confidentiality. But one thing that I did learn is that they are valuable. They are valuable. And I think that when you are in positions that don't make you feel valuable, you lose your value. And it's
Yes.
okay to walk away and know that you are still valuable and that you did make contributions, even if, you know, certain people didn't see what they were, you know what they were.
Like you said, you have to find that value within yourself and appreciate yourself, know your
Sure.
self-worth.
Sure.
How can allies or advocates support the mental health and wellness of Black women at work?
You know, it's funny that you asked this question because I had a recent conversation with a woman, and she was speaking to me about how her boss was noticing that she needed extra support, and her boss was prioritizing her advocating for herself, which you don't really hear of those things. So that lets me know that that's a competent boss that is recognizing that this Black woman that I hired, although she's great and she's doing the job, I'm putting a lot on her and I'm not supporting her with where she is. And so I think that it takes a leader who wants another person to lead to recognize that maybe there are things that I can do as a leader to support a woman or support my worker in a way that I didn't do. So I've seen a lot more corporations do retreats. I've seen a lot more mental health moments. I've seen some corporations have therapists on staff or giving breaks. I've been a part of conversations that gave people the platform to be able to speak about, you know, what they're struggling with and how heavy things have been. And so I think the more that we realize the significance of mental health and its value, I think the more that we would be able to lean into that with each other and advocate for other people to have it so that they can have a good space to be able to decompress when they need to. Right now, a lot of employers leave it up to the person. And sometimes people aren't going to always make that decision. They're not going to always like take the step and like, okay, I'm going to use my EAP. I know I have it. And it's plenty of times that people have it and it goes unused every year.
For those who aren't familiar, can you explain what EAP is? What does it stand for?
So EAP is your employee assistant program. And so a lot of companies put quite a bit of money into mental health benefits for their employees. And depending on what company you work for, you could have 3 sessions, 5 sessions, 6 sessions. And for some places, they can be renewable each year. Sometimes they also could be utilized by your family. So you could, if you have a spouse, if you have children, your children could use them. And some of the sessions are free to you if your employer offers it. Now, I can't promise you that every employer offers it, but I do know within these last several years, a lot of companies have invested in this and that they want their employees to be well and they want them to be okay. And so I know that this is something that's offered to a lot of people. So you can either do it via telehealth or you can actually meet a therapist and go in person. I'm actually a provider for CompSych, which is one of the larger EAP providers, and we see quite a few clients, and there are quite a few companies that use CompSych for their mental health benefit. You also can use your therapy dollars on if you have an HSA or a flex spending account. If you didn't know that, those dollars can actually be used towards a therapy session, if you don't necessarily have the funds to pay out of pocket for a therapist.
Okay, listeners, so check your human resources benefits for your EAP, your flexible spending accounts, and your health savings accounts, and utilize that dollar amount.
Sure. Which that's another amount that goes unused almost every year.
Well, before we wrap up, I have a couple of final questions for you. I know you said that you like music and you like to sing. What's your favorite song?
Oh my goodness. So I am an all-time favorite Whitney Houston fan. Rest in peace, Whitney Houston. And when I actually used to do singing competitions, my go-to song was always I Have Nothing. And so I can listen to that song forever and a day. I'm such a Whitney Houston fan. Rest in peace, her soul. I love R&B, soul music. So if I had to have like a top five li list, Whitney Houston is on my list. Aretha Franklin's on my list. I am a huge fan of Beyonce, obviously. but I also like new artists. Like I'm a big fan of her. I love SZA. I love
Okay.
all the R&B ladies and their music and their contributions to the music we have today. And I love people that sing. Sing, sing. When I mean sang, it's not sing, it's sang. I love people that sang.
Do you do karaoke or go to like open mics or anything?
I do. I recently just started kind of getting back into music. So when I was in high school, I actually was in a singing group and we had like our whole little group name and we performed at in our high school. And I used to do competitions and try out, and I kind of gave it a rest when I decided to be a therapist. But lately, Angela, this work is so hard some days that I need my own self-care. And so music has always been like a huge self-care to me. So you can always find me at somebody's show, somebody's concert. I would say the last time I did karaoke was probably 2 weeks ago. And I'm trying to think, what did I sing? I sung Mary J. Blige. I'm going down. That was my last song that I recently did.
All right. Well, final question. What do you do when you aren't fearlessly leading? How do you recharge?
What do I do? So I love to travel and I love food. So I like to try new restaurants in the city, or if I'm traveling, I want to try something new. That's what I really enjoy, and I like going to new places. I'm such a big fan of amazing views. So wherever I go, I want to see like a beautiful view, and I want to have good food. That's important to me.
Yes, I'm a foodie as well. So what's the latest restaurant that you tried in Philadelphia that you recommend?
The latest restaurant that I went to recently, well, it's not really new, but I love their brunch. So I love Sabrina's in
Okay.
Philly. I love their brunch. And as far as like soul food, the most recent soul food place I went to was Amina's. I love their food as well. And if I had to say, one of my top places, I always love going to Budokan. It never gets old
Oh
to
yeah, so
me.
I've been to all three. So I guess we're in good company because we like all the same things.
Yes, it never gets old to me at all. But I know that there's quite a few new places in Philly that I have to check out. So I have a couple of food dates coming up.
Okay. Well, April, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today. How can our listeners stay connected with you?
Yeah, so of course, if you are interested in getting your degree in marriage and family therapy, you can find me at LaSalle University and you can apply for our master's program in marriage and family therapy. If you are interested in therapeutic services that's not at LaSalle, then you can find me at my practice, which is April Lances and Associates. That's in Bala Cynwyd, Pennsylvania. And if you just like to be on Instagram, I just recently started getting into Instagram. So I'm ALA Therapy on Instagram. And those are the ways that you can check me out. Our website for the practice is www.alatherapy.com. And if you are interested in therapy, please send us a message and shoot us an email. If you're a therapist and you're thinking about joining a practice, then come on aboard. And once we have our posting, we will be reviewing resumes to join our wonderful practice.
And I will make sure all of that information is included in the show notes.
Thank you, Angela. It was good to talk to you and see you.
Thank you so much, April. Well, that's all for today's episode. Until next time, goodbye, everyone. Thank you for listening to the Flow Podcast. As we wrap up today's episode, always remember, your unique path, your voice, and your leadership matter. If you loved what you heard, subscribe now to stay updated on our latest episodes. Take a moment to leave a review and share this episode with someone who can benefit from these conversations. You can stay connected with me on Instagram at The Flow Podcast with Angela, or visit me on the web at angelavharris.com. Until next time, take care, stay inspired, and keep fearlessly leading in your own way.